Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. I'm back. I'm relaxed.
She's back.
I'm way too tan for November in Cincinnati.
You look so rested and relaxed, and I think your hair is more blonde. It must be just the natural sun of California.
Absolutely.
That. Yeah, nothing artificial going on there.
I'm here with my co-host, Burl Love. Today's special guest is, I'm very excited. This is someone I love talking to, just myself. And so I'm excited to kind of bring conversation to you guys. It's Cincinnati Fire Chief Michael Washington. He's a natural born storyteller. And I was kind of like making a list of all the questions I wanted to ask. And I was like, I don't even know why I'm doing this, because he's going to talk and we're going to listen because he's amazing.
We're just going to tee him up and let him go.
Exactly. And we're going to, at the end, or with Michael at least, reveal who won Real Men Wear Pink. Do we know yet, Burl?
You know, we know who's
mostly.
Yeah, there's still a lot of fundraising that kind of comes in after October is over, and there's actually one more event which we can talk about at the end too.
Okay.
But yeah, it's been a pretty good campaign, and Michael is, he's wearing his pink accented fire chief uniform.
Yes, sharp. I would like to see his closet too.
Yeah, for sure.
So we're going to get right to the beginning segment of this because I dragged in an extra special guest today.
Extra special guest.
He is super busy. Scott Scoop Wortman is joining us in the studio today. He has been our main election coverage. And I know his story list remains long. TikTok, it's almost November 8th, election day. But we're going to talk about some of his county reporting, and we might peek into some
election
stuff.
Let's cut to the chase. We were talking a few weeks ago how unfortunate it is that a publicly owned stadium, which is Paycor, we have no idea what the naming rights went for. And we still don't know exactly what we went for, but thanks to Scott's scoop, say that 10 times fast, we know that it was under the magic threshold of what, 60 million?
Something like that. Or at least they managed to wrangle accounting-wise to make it under 60 million. It could have been, and it seems like it was likely much more, but they used some definitions.
Take us back.
Break it down exactly for those who don't remember or didn't listen. What does the agreement with the Bengals dictate as far as what the county would get when they sell the naming rights?
When the lease was signed in the late 90s.
Between the county taxpayers and the Bengals. Go.
Yeah. Exactly, because I'm going to need a lot of help with forgetting legal terms here, because it's intentionally dense, because a lot of lawyers are involved. The county, or the Bengals, initially would get $16 million, the first $16 million of the naming rights, and then after that, 70%. Of the additional revenue, and the county would get 30%. But there's a multiplier in the lease, what multiplies by like 6% each year. So
dating back to 2000. Yes.
So that number now is $60.5 million. But there's also additional legal language in there called fulfillment costs, which whoever buys the naming rights, they can also buy private suites, advertising, additional signage on like the scoreboard. And that can also be part of the deal, but not go towards the 60 million. So
just to break it down into easy to follow numbers.
No, that's not true.
I mean, I guess to sum up, basically, Paycor, it appears, has it's an undisclosed amount, but that involves both buying the naming rights as well as like private suites, tickets.
Right.
So who knows how big it is.
So if they would have gotten, for example, $70 million, the first $60 million stays with the Bengals, and then the additional $10 million would be 70-30, 70 to the Bengals. So
minus the cost of all the signage.
We'll get that in a second. Okay. We'll get that in a second. So which is like, with no other bells and whistles happening here, they needed to get more than $60 million for the taxpayers to actually have some money get kicked back for the naming rights. However, nothing's ever that simple. As you reported, the Bengals, when they put this deal together, gave them also the opportunity to spend their money with luxury suites, signage, all of that coming off of the top figure, so that whatever that number was, whatever they paid for naming rights, even if it was hitting the threshold where the taxpayers, where the county would get some money back, it probably would have been used for other things before we got that number. So what we know for sure, Scott, is that it was less than $60 million.
That is well put. Yeah. Well, the naming rights portion of it was less than say, and the whole problem with this, and even from the county's end, they have not been told what the deal is. So it's completely the Bengals' word for it.
So putting on your spot, do you believe that Jeff Aluto, the county administrator, doesn't have off the record an agreement that he can look at that he doesn't know the exact number?
I mean,
to verify that they have no dog in this hunt anymore, that the dollars are too small to hit that threshold. And so it really doesn't matter if it was $50 million, $40 million, $5, doesn't matter as far as the county's concerned, because that it didn't hit the threshold for some money to be returned to the county.
Well, as you can attest, both Sherry and I have asked for, I guess that would be 4 months now, for records. We've gotten partial open records requests of communications between commissioners, the Bengals, and staff. It's turned up nothing. Like they've in emails that the commissioners have made with constituents, they've all said we don't have any information on this deal. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me.
It doesn't come down to I don't think that we should even suppose if they know.
Yeah.
That's fine. They say they don't. I'm going to take them at their word that they don't know. That begs the question, why don't they know? Did they ask? That's where we're at. What's the communications between the commissioners and Jeff Aluto and the Bengals? And the Bengals don't have to tell us. We've been very clear about this. They're a private company. But the way the lease works, everything on the county end is. Yeah. And so this story's not done. The story isn't done because we don't know. The question now is, why don't we know?
And we still have unfulfilled open records requests from the county that, I mean, they have tried to filibuster and stonewall as long as they can, giving clear answers. However, I think them not knowing, that doesn't make them look good.
I agree. But I think somebody knows. I mean, how could they not? Right? This is Cincinnati. Somebody knows.
Well, definitely someone with Paycor and the Bengals know.
Well, Scott,
Mike Brown,
as you mentioned, you've been making the public records request. You've been on this. At least we know now. I mean, question number one is, especially with, you know, the county being in the situation that they are going to have to, in 2026, have a new lease with the team, there's going to be some list of improvements that the stadium will need, that the county will be on the hook for, at least in part. It would have been nice that the naming rights deal would have helped in that cause. Obviously, it won't. It will help the Bengals, but it's not really going to help the owner of the stadium, and that's the public through the county. What do you think will be the what's the document you will need, you know, with all these records requests? Is there some sort of, you know, report that the Bengals, as tenants of the stadium, like an annual report or something like that, that shows, you know, that what their income is as far as the stadium is concerned?
I mean, I've asked for any and all documents related to the naming rights. I don't know what that would be. I mean, they don't have to submit like a regular report that I'm aware of. They get the county manages the stadium fund, which the half-cent sales tax that paid for the construction, but that comes directly to the county.
I have to tell you, things have become more opaque as time has gone on. Now, I cover the county. This is why I've been helping Scott some. I covered the county between 2010 and 2014, and that is when the stadium fund was underperforming. So I have like a really good understanding of how the stadium fund works. And when it was underperforming, it was a very big concern, because what were they going to do about that? But every month that they came in, they once a month with the county meetings, they had a spreadsheet of everything like Bengals related, where the money was coming in, where it was going out, all the way through. At that point, the lease was ending in 2026, not 2032, right? It was pushed out. And so I had a good understanding of it at all times of what was happening. And now when we went to even write these first stories, right, we're like, how much money's in the stadium fund? It's nowhere apparent, like, of how much money that we're putting in. And this is going to be very important coming up as the commissioners again decide whether they want to keep their promise or not keep their promise about giving the rollback to county taxpayers.
Well, the stadium fund brings in about $90 million a year, the half-cent sales tax, and they have $46 million of that. They're just stockpiling for a rainy day, quote-unquote.
Well, and that's the part two. That's the rest of the story.
We're getting ahead of ourselves.
That's right. You also reported that the let's call it a rebate to county taxpayers from the half-cent sales tax, that the county does have some discretion as far as what gets returned to property owners, if anything. That was a little lower than some people might have expected this year or wanted this year as well.
Compared to last year, although that's become the norm in the last decade, property owners are supposed to get, based on the promise that was made by the commissioners in the 90s when the whole stadium deal was struck, they're supposed to get 30% of that 90 or so million that the sales tax gets brings in. They're supposed to get 30% of that back in the form of a rollback rebate on their property tax bill. But over the last 10 years, the commissioners have rarely done that. Their argument for that is that the projections of the sales tax in the 1990s was supposed to grow over 3% each year, and they said that it just doesn't do that anymore.
Right, it was a little bleak.
Yeah. So they claim that the projections in the 90s were overly rosy and unrealistic for the current situation. Although they can easily still afford it, they claim that that's not fiscally responsible.
And when you say they—
I meant the county administration, I'm sorry.
Right,
so they're concerned about fiscal responsibility, but that yet they don't know the amount of money the naming rights is worth? I don't understand.
Well, they know enough. They know they're not going to get any money from the deal. At least we know that. Well, so remind me, I know Dumas, who's running for reelection, was concerned and wanted to keep some of that money this year. Where did the other commissioners fall?
Denise Drias has not said. She said she wants to do more research. Alicia Reese, and like last year, she supports giving the full 30% back.
Have they voted yet?
I'm sorry?
Have they voted yet?
They have until December 1st to get it to the auditor. So it'll be sometime in the next couple weeks. They don't meet
next week.
That'll
be the Wednesday before December 1st, probably. Whatever that is.
It usually is. Because they vote on this every year. It usually is late November.
So it'll be after the election, so Stephanie Dumas doesn't have to worry about it being an issue for her. She can hedge her bets right now.
Although each year that they do, it's usually late November anyways, even in a non-election year. So
I can promise you guys something. I was just talking about this. I don't want to say about what, that we're looking for something from another elected official. And this person was like, any minute now. I'm like, no, not till after the election. Anybody who's in elected office, whether they're up for election right now or not, they're thinking about their party and anything news they make, how it can be spun politically. Like, these jobs are political. And so all of these, any information that flows out, November 8th is a marker in everybody's heads because they're worried about how things look before the election. So anyway.
Well, Scott, great reporting, great insight. It is fascinating.
Thanks for coming into the studio today.
It was really
today.
Exciting to be back on this podcast. It's been a minute.
All right. Well you're covering the election, so we'll have you back.
We will have you back. And now we're going to go from extra guest to scheduled guest. I believe it's time for Chief Washington.
Thanks, guys.
It's good to see you, Chief Washington.
Hey, Sherry, how are you today? It's a nice cloudy Wednesday in this great city of Cincinnati.
I know, and I heard that you're fresh off a trip to another city.
Yeah, our neighbors up to the north, the mistake by the lake.
Oh.
Cleveland, city of Cleveland.
Now, you're going to start a bunch of trouble calling Cleveland the mistake by the lake.
Well, they do have nice parks and a interesting football team. Let's just say that.
So he's just smarting.
Do you travel to watch the Bengals Or is this just a was this a special occasion?
No, I've seen them in Dallas. I've seen them in Atlanta. I've seen them in Cleveland, in Pittsburgh, and it's about the same effect. So
I just recently read something about our on the road record. You're not the problem, are you? Are you superstitious?
I could be bad luck. I know that we've not been so successful with our neighbors to the north. So hopefully when we see them again here then in the next or December,
they don't even know this state, Paycor Stadium, fool. They don't even know these teams. They don't know what's coming when they come. Like I'm like overwhelmed and have never seen it like it is this year at Paycor Stadium. So
I will say I was there when they played Atlanta, and it was a phenomenal, exciting game, unlike the one we just witnessed on Monday night.
All right. I have to tell you, I'm kind of surprised that you have time for football. I think that you work 24 hours a day and you're on the job like 18 months, right?
Yeah. Well, that's the only time I get a chance to be off is when I leave the city of Cincinnati, which I try to do about every 6 weeks. I try to kind of, you know, duck a little bit and get a little bit of repolarization and relaxation. So, but when I'm in the city, it's like having the cape. Whenever there's an emergency, you can find Car One in action.
Car One?
Car One. You know, I've seen this in action myself. Last year, we were at a dinner together at the Boathouse. It was the Real Men Wear Pink cigar dinner. And I've told this story before, but now that Michael's here, we can hear it from his,
His
perspective. He thought he was going to enjoy a peaceful evening, you know, a nice dinner, smoke a few cigars, raise money for a good cause. Dean Gregory, the owner of the Boathouse, he's doing an auction, you know, auctioning off all kinds of stuff, bottles of bourbon. I can't even remember all the things. And someone came up to Dean in the middle of this. He's got the microphone in his hand. And at first he was kind of like brushing them off, like, can't you see I'm busy up here? And then they're like, no, like, look, the restaurant's on fire. And smoke was indeed pouring from the roof of the Boathouse. This was a year ago, October. And how fortunate for all of us there that Car One wasn't just nearby. He was sitting there ready to leap into action. So he was literally, you know, the expression, hold my beer. He was like, hold my beer. And
My Monte Cristo.
Yeah. Hopefully you snuffed it out so there wasn't going to be another fire there. And literally leapt into action. By the time the night was over, I mean, he was out front. He was like dragging hose. He was on the radio. I've never seen, I mean, when Car One's already on the scene, you know that the rest of the department's going to show up quickly. But it was impressive to watch. I'm giving him a hard time, but I actually got to see Chief Washington not just being an administrator, but a firefighter. How often does that happen?
Really, I will have to say it happens more often than you know. I do spend a large amount of my time in the city of Cincinnati after hours. So I'm always kind of, you know, listening to see what's going on. And I'm still a firefighter at heart. So whenever there's we call it a job, working fire going, I'm there bird dogging. So, So
what do you keep in the car?
I have the same thing they have.
Just in your car, like in the
trunk. The same thing they have on the apparatus is in my car. So when dispatch gets a pending call that's in the queue waiting to be dispatched, I see the same thing the guys on the street see. So, yeah.
And how is that? Do you feel like you're welcomed to the fire scenes? Or are the men like,
Well, I think just because of how I came up in the organization, they're used to seeing me. Yeah, I spend time at Finley Market on Saturdays feeding the dogs, Eden Park, Mount Echo Park, you know, so wherever there's something going on, Avondale, watching the Little League football teams play at South Avondale Field. I still spend a lot of time in the city. I get my hair cut in the city. I buy my groceries in the city. I know Mr. Neil Lucan down at Lucan's Meats. So I'm not a Renaissance guy, so to speak, but people know me when they see me, so I try to be accessible.
And when you say you get your hair cut in the city, that takes what, all of like 2 seconds? I mean, you got.
It's tough questions today.
Well, when you become a 50-year-old man, you don't have much up there on the As my son would say, he's on the job. He's a firefighter.
I mean, you're not just high and tight. You're like,
yeah, I got a sunroof.
You do.
I got a sunroof.
The helmet fits better that
way,
right?
Yes. So my brother cuts my hair. He's up on West Charlton, up by UC. He has a barbershop up there. So you'll see me there once a week on the job, but he's got the straight razor in my head, and in about 5 or 6 minutes, I'm done. So
tell us just briefly, you talked about coming up through the department. What is the Michael Washington story as far as when you joined the department and your path to becoming chief?
So you want the official when I started on the fire department, or you want when I was paid to be on the fire department? Which story do you want to hear?
I think the most intriguing one. We like when our guests kind of break news and go behind the scenes. So keep it real.
Oh, well, I'll keep it 100, as the young people say out there. I was a firehouse brat. My local firehouse, Engine 5, McMicken and Vine, Over the Rhine. I'm an Over the Rhine kid, West End kid. So, yeah, I was kind of adopted by the local firehouse down in Over the Rhine. And I kind of came in, learned how to clean up, learned how to load the apparatus with hose, and learned all about how the fire department operated. And I never left.
So that's like where some kids will be hanging out at the baseball field or hanging out at the corner, causing trouble. You were hanging out at the fire department.
Yeah.
Did they adopt you?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, back in those days, there was no genie for the garage doors, right? So Engine 5 at that time was one of the busier engine companies in the city. So they prided themselves getting out the door quick. They still do it to this day. They clear the house pretty quick. And so what I would do is I was the guy that stayed back to close the garage door to make sure the firehouse was secured. And I would get on my bike and I knew where they were going. So I would cut through the alleyways and byways and triways, and I was on the scene. So they would put me to work.
And how old were you then?
7.
That's incredible.
So.
And this wasn't the days. So the streets are all kind of the same. The firehouse is certainly the same. It needs a little work. But these were the days of like the wood buildings and Over the Rhine. And these fires that you would go to, I had a chance to see some of it on the wall of that firehouse and everything. We're talking about spectacular fires of like not the building codes today where you get there. And sometimes we see these huge fires. But back then it was you're going to burn.
And we'll probably get into this a little more, but that kind of predates the
smoke detectors.
Well, and also the emphasis from the fire department on prevention and inspection as opposed to just reaction.
Well, 1955, the Cincinnati Fire Department was one of the first departments in the country to actually do in-home fire inspections in the neighborhood. But of course, this is an industrial kind of city, you know, dates back to the 1700s. What we call old type 3 wooden brick joist buildings, the heavy timber buildings like Longworth Hall, those manufacturing buildings were real prominent back then. So the city took on kind of like image of that type of construction. So those buildings for firefighters, for us to go into those buildings, are quite unique. They're usually pretty sturdy. They stand up pretty heavy in fire activity. But the new lightweight constructed buildings of the 70s, 80s, and of course now is all pre-engineered lumber. So you don't have a lot of time to fight fires in those.
They burn quick.
Very quick. And they structurally are unsound after roughly about 10 minutes of fire activity. They don't hold up very well. They defy gravity. Buildings defy gravity. So when they fall down, it shouldn't be like a surprise.
Right. I guess that's why they call those stick built, right?
Pretty much. I mean, a nominal piece.
2x4s? Yeah,
it's not even 2x4 anymore. It's laminated wood just pressed together.
Yeah.
And the glue and the resins, when they heat up, they delaminate and the building comes down.
So now that you're the chief, is it as easy as – is it what you thought it would be? and, you know, all those things that when you're the employee, you're like, oh, I would do this and I would do that. Not that I'm like that, Burl. But if I was the boss
– oh, she has her list.
So, like, are you able to kind of implement that list? Are you finding things are not exactly how you thought?
Firefighters are type A personalities. We want to solve problems quickly. And then when you go from being an operations person on the street, you know, running fire ground operations, handling major medical emergencies, things of that nature, shootings, trauma runs, and things of that nature, you get used to quick results. You know, there's a cause and effect. As you go to the management side of things, your counterparts, your internal partners with other departments within the city, outside of the city, your elected officials, your executive staff. They work a little slower. Things are a little slower paced. So patience and relationship management are the most important at this level. And I was already attuned to that. But you have to articulate that to the rank and file and basically in firefighter language that they can understand. So I find myself explaining a lot down through the ranks, and it's okay. But change and the way things are two things firefighters do not like. So you have to take that with a grain of salt.
Do you feel like that you've had – you came in, you know, kind of like – I won't want to say the tail end of the pandemic, but when we were all kind of getting back out there, and the firefighters, it wasn't necessarily mandatory overtime, but there was a lot of work to be done and they all pitched in and they worked a lot of overtime. How are you managing that now? How is everyone doing?
So, you know, we're no different than any other major metropolitan city. Of course, the workforce has been challenged through this pandemic. This is like a 100-year situation. None of us seen it before. And when you have something that was this devastating, it does have affect the rank and file. But we are recovering. The city executive staff, along with council, approved a $10 million budget increase to my 2023 fiscal budget. And that included two additional fire recruit classes that were they gave me 50 plus fire recruits instead of 40. So we're in 53 for this class is in right now. It started in October, and we have another class started in June of almost 55. So that'll get us toward our authorized strength. So we're moving in the right direction. And we also had them give us an additional $2 million to support the overtime for a firefighter rehire callback.
Have we had to have any brownouts?
Not necessarily. We did have a little run in during the holidays last year. We had to work through that. But ordinarily, all 26 fire stations, 55 companies are staffed 24/7. I have to have 193 firefighters, paramedics, and EMTs on duty daily in the city. And I can say this for the Cincinnati Fire Department. We are one of the few fire departments in this region that has 4-person minimum manning on all the fire apparatus. And we have a paramedic on everything that has wheels on it. So that's a great thing. The city is definitely investing their money well when it comes to public safety with the fire department.
I remember other communities I'm familiar with fighting over the minimum staffing for each, what do you call them, units or crews?
Fire companies.
Mm-hmm. How large is the department total personnel?
It's 841 strong. We're somewhere around 800 right now. We should probably be a little higher than that because we've actually added some additional resources out there. And so we're working towards building the department to where it should be. And the electeds and the executive staff are aware of that. So.
And you mentioned each company having at minimum one paramedic. I think a lot of people realize this, but not everyone. When someone calls 911, if there is a medical emergency, you're just as likely to see a fire truck roll up with an EMT or a paramedic as you are, you know, a traditional life squad unit.
So, yes. Yeah, so the paramedic model here in Cincinnati is probably one of the, if not the original, close to being the original back in the 1970s. I think you remember Johnny and Roy in Emergency, where they had L.A. County had their rescue squad and the fire apparatus.
Sherry might be too young to remember that show.
Probably just a little bit.
Yeah. So that was the
my parents watched Emergency.
That was the origin in TV land on paramedicine. But really, paramedicine goes back to Pittsburgh.
He's rolling his eyes. I wish we had video on him right now.
I have to say that.
He barely could get the word out without rolling his eyes.
My buddy's the fire chief. Dr. Daryl Jones is the fire chief of the Pittsburgh Bureau of Fire. We talk trash each other every week about the Bengals and the Pittsburgh Steelers. But actually, there was a place called the Freedom House, which was actually a hospital that employed veterans from the Vietnam War, laid off truckers, actually
ex-cons to actually enter into the realm of emergency medicine, which was the Freedom House, and they were actually African-Americans. So the paramedic program, as you see it in most cities, that's where it actually came from, was the Freedom House in Pittsburgh. Now, back to the city of Cincinnati Fire. We started paramedicine in the 70s based off some of those programs, Columbus, Houston, Miami, L.A. County, L.A. City. And then in 1986, the Cincinnati Police decided they didn't want to do basic life support transports in their police cars. So we actually bought 5 ambulances and we put firefighter EMTs on those in 86. And so now it's grown to 12 medic units throughout the city. So basically every other house has a paramedic transport unit with at least one paramedic on board. And then all of our 26 engine companies, our 12 ladder companies are staffed with at least one paramedic. And they carry the same thing that a paramedic transport unit has, except for a stretcher. So we'll be at your door within 3, 4, or 5 minutes, and we're going to give you the best care. And a lot of times you hear this thing, well, I called for an ambulance, and why'd you send this big, big fire truck? Well, if you look at any of the TV shows, Chicago Med, Grey's Anatomy, when you see somebody giving somebody hospital care in the emergency department, which is a little bit different than pre-hospital care, it's a team of people. You have a doctor, a nurse, a radiologist, a social worker taking notes. You have somebody scribing. You might have a gopher. You might have a resident. So there's a lot of people in that patient. So it's the same kind of thing. You're going from one entity, from fire and EMS, basically over to the hospital staff. So
do you watch shows? Do you watch like the fire? Because there are a lot of them, right? Are you able to watch them, or do you just cringe and you can't?
I can't. I think after Backdraft.
Oh.
I mean, it's Hollywood. It's Hollywood. You have to have a story. If you were actually really recording an actual firefighting operation, you couldn't see anything. It's totally dark. It's hot. It's really hot. And then you're listening for people crying for help. You're listening for the crackle of the fire. The other firefighters around you are doing what they do, radio chatter. There's a lot going on. It's a very dynamic situation. So you wouldn't be able to really record a show based off what we really do, because we really work in the dark.
Can you look back on the fires that you've personally responded to? Are there any that stick out in your memory that will never, you just won't forget? They'll always be with you?
Well, firefighters have a million stories as it relates to what, you know, what block you were in, what time of year it was. I mean, it's funny because I talk to the old retired guys because I'm getting close to that time to go out the door, and they still, the wives or girlfriends, will say, yeah, he'll be driving down the street and says, we had a job here and it was a 3-alarm, it was a fire here. You remember things by where they were at. But I would say the most memorable fire for me, and unfortunately it was the fire where me being the incident commander in the 4th District, where we unfortunately lost my good friend Daryl Gordon, that sustained a fatal injury when he fell several floors in the elevator shaft. So that would be the most notable fire that I've had to deal with. But I have gone to disaster zones in other cities, and those are memorable as well.
Do you feel like that the city, because there was a lot was said after Daryl died, and to fix the elevators and get the fire department the things they needed, do you feel like that's all been fixed with these buildings, with these elevators, and things are safer now as a result?
I think we work hand in hand with buildings and inspections. I think they're definitely doing due diligence, but there can always be an example where something gets missed. There's no 100% system out there. I think people are more educated. They're more aware of those types of things. As it relates to the fire department, after action report came out, there were several. The fire department has been doing a lot of progression towards some things we fell short on that day. So we're doing a lot better and we're still moving.
So I know you kind of referred, oh, I'm old and da-da-da, which is actually not true.
I am
no.
old. My back is killing me.
Well, that happens when you are about to get old.
Okay.
Are you really going to retire soon? Are you in a retirement program?
Yes. Yes. I'm in the deferred retirement option
program. Oh, no. What?
And well, let me say it like this. Okay. So when you come on, the old timers tell you, hey, kid, enjoy this time because it's going to go fast. And I would go, these guys are nuts. This is taking forever. Well, they're not nuts. It does go fast. If I could do it all over again, I would. My body would not allow me to do it all over again. But yeah, a lot of my friends have retired. And so a lot of the chemistry, if you will, is with the people you came in with. My class of 1993, there's only 12 of us left who came in with a class of 40. So a lot of the people you grew up with, you came up with, you cut your teeth on, you made your bones with, are gone. So it's not as fun anymore because you don't really know anybody anymore.
Okay, I'm going to believe you. I do think that you have – I always see you having fun.
Yeah, well, firefighters are firefighters. They're like that all day long. But it's a little bit special when you have a personal connection with people you actually came up with. And they're going out the door in droves. It's just – I just really don't know a lot of people like I used to.
Okay. I mean, we have heard we report a lot on the retirements at the police department. When is your drop date, do you want to say?
It's between now and then.
Oh, how about this? I understand. Is it before this mayor's term is up? So will we see it like in the next 3 years?
I'll take it day by day. We're having fun right now. I'm still enjoying the job. But you do have people that call and ask questions about what your intentions are down there.
Trying to push you out? No.
Not from here, but other people, other places. So
I see.
Yeah. So.
All right. Well, I do feel like I don't like to give my opinion too much, but I feel like I've heard from the firefighters that you've just been such a breath of fresh air, that they really appreciate that you have come from them and you haven't forgotten.
Yeah, well, you know, I try to get out to the companies every Tuesday. I set a lunch appointment with a fire company every Tuesday. And what I do, maybe a little bit different than the past chiefs, is that I stay an hour because they're busy. They have enough to do, and have a white shirt in the house, a white hat in the house. It's a little unsettling sometimes, but I spent 30 minutes eating with them and then 30 minutes talking about what we're doing. And it's for all my division chiefs. They report out. So it's not you necessarily send out an email or a general order or a notice. They hear it from us. And so I try to avoid that they said or he said or I heard that. So now you heard it directly from us. And I think that cuts down on a lot of the activity, a lot of the chatter, because if you don't tell your story, somebody will tell it for you. Presence at fire grounds. I am, like I said, if there's some action going on, I might just pop up. But I'm not
and
there.
And the day I spent with you when you first were hired as chief, you drove the truck. And you drove it really well. We zipped in and out backwards.
Once a driver, always a driver. You know,
that before you got into the ranks of administration, what was your forte? A driver?
Well, yeah. I mean, I worked in all of the different classifications of the ranks throughout the department. So I came from Green Township. I was the only African American in Green Township for 3 years out of 100 guys. I learned a lot. I had some good times. I had some bad times there, but more good than bad. So when I got on the job here, I kind of already knew where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do, and I just kind of didn't stop. So I took every promotional test that came up. Sometimes I was successful in promoting and not so much at other times, but I just never gave up. So I was a paramedic, still a paramedic, but I don't function on the street. I was a fire apparatus operator, so I drove the engine companies, the ladder companies, the heavy rescue. Then I decided I didn't like standing outside, so I wanted to get in where the good stuff was at, and I became a lieutenant. And I had an awesome time being a lieutenant, an engine boss. I was on some of the busier companies in the city. Then I took a captain's exam my second time around, and I got promoted and spent some time on a ladder company. I spent some time being on the engine company 3 downtown with the boat, fire boat. And then I got a call from the fire chief one day, and it was like, hey, I need somebody to go to training. And somebody to be the captain of training. I'm like, hey, I'm an instructor, but I don't know how to do that. He goes, well, here's your keys to your car. Here's your keys to the office. You can figure it out. Here's your computer. So, and then that was my administration time. I started admin, and I did that for a while. Was the captain of communications. That's when I was a PIO. So I did that for about 4.5 years and got promoted to district chief and went back out to the field.
I don't think I knew you were a PIO.
Yeah, I was a PIO.
No, I did.
I went
he
to media school
so
and everything.
Good.
Really?
Yeah.
So PIO. That's when I was not in Cincinnati.
Yeah, you weren't here then. You were out west.
Either there or D.C. But I'm surprised you came into this newsroom after being a PIO because
I asked her. I said, hey, what's the questions?
And for those who don't know, PIO stands for
Public Information
Officer. I mean, Public Information Officer.
Yeah, so, yeah, I did that. It was fun. It was fun to work on the other side of the camera, too, and learn what you guys need and how your news cycles work. But, of course, everything now is instantaneous. Your news cycle is not like it used to be. And, you know, you got pretty boy Saunders over there at CPD, you know.
Ouch. I'm going to hear about this because he's dealing real men wear pink, too.
Old rock jaw, you know.
We'll have to get into that in a little bit.
Old chisel chin over there.
We'll have him on the podcast. Yeah. That would be fun.
Oh, yeah, we should. Now, I can look it up. So you better be honest with me.
He's in charge of homicide. I think we should be clear because he did do information. And he was also great.
Yes.
You were two of my favorites for real. I'm not just saying that.
Called him Chisel Chin back there in the day.
That's still true.
He does strike a like textbook, you know, tall, square jaw cop kind of thing, you know, which is funny because he's probably one of the nicest guys. But walking up to him, you're like, ooh.
Yes. It's totally off-putting because you go, I think this guy's going to strangle me.
Right. So,
and he's this nice guy.
So you mentioned Captain Saunders is one of the real men who wear pink raising money like I am and like Chief Washington is. Are you out fundraising? What did you call him? Captain Chisel Chin?
Is that your list of things to do?
Captain Chisel Chin? I'm doing my best. I'm not passing out cards like somebody that I know.
Oh, well, I'm pulling out all the stops, you know. Yes. No,
we're going to talk about that at the end.
Well, we've had fun working on this together and getting to know each other. But so I have for the chief, like a rapid fire question round. But before I do that, I want to make sure you brought in notes, like you came prepared. Is there something
your to-do list?
No. These are things that I've already done.
Is there something we didn't ask you that our listeners, that the citizens of Cincinnati need to know? Like, did you come here with a message? Did you come here to break some news?
Yes, please.
What do you got? Like, it's your open question.
Well, okay, I'll say this. So for the longest time, we struggled with child restraint systems, car seats. And so, you know, I was interviewing for fire chief. I was like, you know, we have 21,000 at that time, 21,000 young people under the age of 5 that we weren't really paying too much attention to. And we were actually, that work was going to Children's Hospital. And I said, you know what, we should be in the, we're in the community risk reduction business and they're part of our constituency. So recently here in, I believe September, I had two fire specialists trained in car seat installation and inspection. So now we can have people go on our website. I believe it's on a certain day of the week, every week, at a certain particular firehouse, and we're going to inspect and install car seats. So that's one of the things that I can announce. And we've had some donations from the Reds, the Castellinis, and we're always looking for funding for things like this because these things are important. Every time I see a child that's not restrained, it bothers me. So,
which it does happen. And car seats are not inexpensive, and they're very hard to install. You could be the most educated person looking at those directions, and you're worried about doing it while you're doing it because it's your most precious cargo. Yeah. And you're like, no, I can't do this.
Do you have some background with this?
I do. I have a 14-year-old, but I do remember.
You put him in a car seat still?
Huh? No, but I remember. I feel like it's the same because it was very hard. I went to the Delhi Fire Department, and they helped me. I just stopped by.
Uh-huh.
Smaller.
Okay. Yeah, Delhi. All right.
I live there.
You know, I remember when my son was young, I thought, like, well, we only need one car seat because how hard can it be just to, like, take it out and put it in the right car, right? And every other parent was like, nope, that's going to last, like, 2 weeks and you're going to buy a car seat for each car.
And the grandparents.
And sure enough, we did because it's just – they're not easy to put in and out. And, you know, we were fortunate we could purchase a car seat for each car. But you're touching on something that I think is very important, that there are a lot of people who don't have the luxury – they might have an older car that doesn't have the modern anchor points, and it takes that expertise to put that car seat in so it actually functions properly. So tell me again, you can go on the website.
So you can go on our website. It's the Cincinnati Fire Department's homepage, and then there's a tab there that talks about car seat safety and installation, and there we'll instruct you to how the program works. And I have two fire specialists that have the certification to actually do the inspection and the installations. So that's one of the things I could talk about. What else would you like to talk about? I do have a few others.
Do well, it.
You tell us, yeah.
Okay, so recently we have this. So back in the old days, a couple days ago, Cincinnati was one of the first few cities in the United States that had the telegraph box alarm system. And it was before radios. So it used to have the red boxes on the corners, and those were called box alarms. And so how we would dispatch a company to that location was somebody would go out and pull the handle, kind of like me when they thought I pulled the box, and then the fire department would show up. Of course, those went away, and people have cell phones now, and everything's by GPS or GIS. And so we've gone away from that old technology. And now, since we have GPS and global positioning satellites, things of that nature, we installed several years back something called automatic vehicle locators. And what the automatic vehicle locator does is it talks to the computer-aided dispatch system at the dispatch center. And so what we do now is instead of sending the closest firehouse to that emergency, we will send the closest available fire unit where it is positioned on the street. So typically, Station X might make a certain address routinely, but if they're out of position and another vehicle's closer, then that unit will be pinged for that response. So a more efficient way to deliver emergency services. So that's something I just pretty much went full AVL not too long ago, and we're having some data. We're getting some good data information on how it's working. And that will help us actually when we have to relocate or rebuild fire stations. It'll tell us kind of where to put them at by service demand. So it's one of the things we got going on right now.
Can you see in the near future building new firehouses?
It's in the plan. It's in the plan. It's always about funding and capital dollars. So
I never hear anything about that.
The electeds are aware, and the executive staff is aware. So I think it'll be sometime in the near future.
So I have a stupid question. Can you explain, because I've never fully understood it, what's the difference between a 3-alarm fire and a 5-alarm fire?
What's the difference between 3-alarm chili and 5-alarm chili?
Heat.
No. So here's how it works. Remember I was talking about the box alarms, right?
Yeah.
So the box alarm used to be on a corner. And then it had a 4-digit number. Okay. So the telegraph system used to punch out the box alarm number. So it'd be, if it was 3-3-3-5, it would be 3-3, 3-3, 5-5.
You mean like?
Yes. And it would tick out a tape.
Okay.
So they could actually pull the tape and count the clicks, and they could look on the board and see what number it is, what address or what intersection it was. And you pull out a card. So if you were the first alarm, it would be like 3 engine companies. 2 ladder companies, 1 chief. That was the response. On that box alarm card, it had 5 alarms, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And it would say the rest of the companies on the second alarm and the third alarm and the fourth alarm. So if you were a company that was not on the first alarm, you pull the ticker tape, you count the strikes on the ticker tape, you pull the box card because everybody had citywide box cards. So your box cards went throughout the whole city. Everybody had the same group of cards. You pull box 3-3-3-5 up, it's at the corner of Hewitt and Hackberry, and if you were on the third alarm and you look down, yep, engine 46, engine 9, engine 14 on the third alarm. So when the incident commander would strike the third alarm after the second alarm, then engine 14 would go on the third alarm. So you kind of knew. So basically, it's more resources per alarm.
So it doesn't necessarily equate to companies.
No.
Because there could be multiple companies on
it's
an alarm.
Multiple companies on an alarm. There's no single company response. So
okay.
It's basically, if I get 3 engines, 2 ladders, and 1 chief on the first alarm, I might get 3 engines, 1 ladder on the second alarm. I might get 3 engines, 1 ladder on the third alarm. I might get 3 engines, 4th alarm. So that's how it goes.
And who makes the decision to pull the next alarm?
The guy with the white hat. The guy with the white coat.
The incident commander.
The incident commander, the boss.
Gotcha.
So I actually knew, like, that I understood how the alarms modern work, but yeah. I had no idea it was based in history, but of course it is. Like,
that's
I didn't know
cool.
You were going to say all that.
Yeah.
Well, but before the box alarms, there was a drum. They used to beat a drum at 9th and Vine Street. So they used to have a big tower, and that's where the fire tower came from, the term fire tower. The fire tower is a dispatch center.
So are you talking like the 30s, 40s?
I'm talking back when there was just stick houses built.
Okay.
And so the fire tower was, there were night watchmen, so he watched over the city for a fire. And if there was a fire in that particular ward, he would bang the drum so many times and they would hear it and they would go. Horses and dogs and all that. Everybody came ready. So.
That's fantastic.
And a Dalmatian. So
now you're able to tell when the closest fire truck is. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, from a drum to a GPS, like on your phone.
All right, I'm going to go in the rapid fire question round now.
Bang, bang, bang.
You have to let him get back to work.
All right. The one thing the city administration could do to make your job easier.
That's not rapid fire. Go.
Well, actually, they're doing something to make my job easier right now. They're actively listening to our issues. They're not being dismissive. They're being very interactive in what our needs are. But our needs are huge. So we know we got to eat this pie one bite at a time. So I think we're in step right now. So that's a good thing.
All right. Your favorite place to have a meal in Cincinnati?
In Cincinnati, where would I like to have a meal? What's my favorite place? Well,
your go-to place.
My go-to place, as you can see from my waistline here, it's I do like Jeff Ruby's. I like a nice steak. But I also go to the places in the old neighborhood. So you might catch me out at Ribs and More on Reading Road right there at Section. So place is only open Wednesday, Thursdays, and Friday. And the old lady in there, she makes one heck of a smothered pork chop with gravy and dressing on the side, spicy greens.
What's
mac
the place
and cheese.
Called again?
It's called Ribs and More.
On Section.
No, Reading and Section.
Okay.
And then there's a place called, it's up on Glenmore. It's called The Crown. Another little spot right at Glenmore in Montana. Another little soul food restaurant. As my son would call it, another joint. So I like getting in there, and he has a nice Philly cheesesteak sandwich. I mean, pretty close to Philly, but he smokes some ribs there too, man. So good stuff, good stuff.
All right.
Which firehouse has the best food? Do you want to say?
That was one of mine, actually, because you know firehouses are known for.
And
you
I
know,
notice you do go so, there yeah, over so, lunch to talk to everybody.
Which company has the best cook? You gotta go. You have to.
It was easier to ask him about the administration than this.
As my son would say, I don't snitch. So
We got more information about when he might retire. Like,
well, no, we're getting into something now. So is that like a big deal?
Oh,
if you
yeah.
were if you were to pick a favorite as far
oh my
as
God.
Would, that,
oh my
would the
God.
Other companies just you
Let
know.
Me say it like this. I get company t-shirts. When they make their t-shirts for their personalized fire companies, I get a t-shirt from most fire companies. And I have to sport that t-shirt when I go to their fire.
Right.
So I have to almost figure out at night when I'm getting up what t-shirt I'm gonna put on with fire.
So there's no way you're gonna tell us which company has the best cook.
No. There's so many good
wow.
cooks out there. I mean, there's.
Do they compete amongst themselves, though?
Absolutely.
Is there like a title of some
they
sort?
They do the chili cook-offs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have they done that lately? No,
they didn't do it last year. We did it the year before, but it, you know, you have so many guys. And I'll say it like this. The old school guys, the old school drivers, the firefighters operators were the ones who cooked in the firehouse. They were the old guys. They had the towel over their shoulder and they had the old black book. And they were really, I mean, they would pass that black book on when they retired. So from sauerbraten to Kraut and Metz to lasagna to minestrone to wedding soup to
man, I'm hungry.
Let me see.
It's lunchtime.
Braised beef. Let me see what other beef stroganoff. Oh my God.
Do those black books still exist?
They're still out there. They're covered. They're still out there. I mean, sweet and sour hot bacon slaw. I mean, just forget about it. Forget
Maybe
about
that's
it.
A Keith Pandolfi
forget about
story
it.
To do
yeah.
like
yeah,
five firehouse recipes or something.
SOS.
Like that.
I can't tell you what that really means.
Well,
hide the meat. So it's just stuff. Just stuff.
Anybody who's in the military knows what SOS is.
I'll pass off.
All right. Final question. If you were not a firefighter, what would you be?
Pilot.
That was easy.
I'm a pilot.
Do you have a pilot's license?
Yes.
Wow. Interesting.
Do you have a plane?
I had one.
But now you work all the time?
Yeah, but as so I work less, I'm going to get another one.
Uh-huh.
I love aviation. I love flying.
Did you
it's
have
so
a,
free.
Did you have like a, what kind of plane did you have?
Piper, Cherokee Piper.
At Lunken?
Yep, Sunken Lunken. K-L-U-K.
When did you kind of get the flying bug?
Actually, when I was in high school, I was in a minority cultures class, and I learned about the Tuskegee Airmen. I never heard about him, and I finally met one here, John Lear. I met him on a run, and they had a club called the Brown Condors, and it was a program for African Americans to learn how to fly in aviation. So I got to fly. I did my ground school, and then I went to Blue Ash, and I did my my flight training there, and that's how I got to do it at a discount. So that's how I got my pilot's license, through the Tuskegee Airmen, through the Brown Condors. So.
I love that answer. That's amazing.
I had no idea. That's
I hope you get the chance to fly, but nobody wants you to leave as chief.
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, well, we're going to let him go because he's
busy man. Busy man. He's got some fundraising to do, too. Catch up with me.
Oh.
And Captain Chiselchin. I can't wait to see Saunders.
I'm the person who's going to get in trouble for this. Oh, no.
Michael, thank you.
You're welcome, Brill. You're welcome. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Cheryl.
I always love catching up with the fire chief. I meant all the things I said, even if I creeped into opinion territory. It was great to see him in person, and I'm very excited to hear about his car seat initiative. You guys are going to read more about that. So thank you for him for joining us and taking time out of his very busy schedule. Trust me, I had to schedule this. All right. So we already talked about Real Men Wear Pink. You're almost done, bro.
We are almost done.
You have one little announcement related to it, though.
Yes. So we have one more Real Men Wear Pink official event. Even though we officially wrap up in October, we carry on at least through the first week of November. So at the Boathouse, Saturday night is a Dean Gregory hosted Real Men Wear Pink party. Anybody can show up. Go to the American Cancer Society website, Cincinnati, get the information. But the Rusty Griswolds will be playing.
That sounds very fun.
Should be a fun event. We're going to auction off a few things. And to wrap up my campaign, I talked Keith Pandolfi, our food writer, into agreeing to be auctioned off for lunch. So
wow.
If you've ever wanted to have lunch with Keith Pandolfi, be at the Boathouse Saturday night and bid. And let's get that bid up there and see what we can do.
I have to tell you, like, one of the things that, like, all right, people ask me about City Hall all the time, obviously. But one of the outside of City Hall things people ask me is they like to ask, ooh, what's Keith Pandolfi like? And they love, he's such a great writer and storyteller. Polly was amazing in her way, and he's amazing in his way. And people, they're curious about him. So I feel
they are. You know, and both Polly and Keith, has carried this tradition forward. Don't write. Polly used to, and she evolved. But Keith is taking it a step further, that he is not the snooty food critic, you know, evaluating the technique of somebody doing a reduction sauce or whatever. He is writing about Cincinnati, the people, the places, through the lens of food and telling stories. But what a great segue, because
I know
this leads into what I think.
Purpose.
You are so good, Sherry. This, I think, leads into our Cincinnati moment of the week. And I'm talking about none other than, and Keith has already written about this, the great Hanky Pank crisis of 2022.
I have to tell you, because I'm not really a food writer, that it didn't occur to me that that should be a story. Shame on me. Because before he even wrote about it, I've actually heard about this crisis.
Oh, yeah. This
and
is the, one
and
of those.
People consider it a crisis.
No, this is one of those things that kind of bubbled up on social media and in conversation that, and we should pause right here. Sherry, can you explain what a hanky pank is?
No, I'm not really good at that. It's a Cincinnati food thing.
Oh, well, I will do
it. I have to tell you, I love them. And you know where I get them?
Where?
Is it Knockback Gnats?
Knockback
Gnats. They make amazing ones.
Well, and more often than not, you're not going to find them in a restaurant. You're going to find them like in the fall and winter and around the holidays in the homes of people across greater Cincinnati, because it's a very popular appetizer. There's different recipes, but essentially it's a small piece of cocktail rye, and we'll get to that in a minute, with some ground beef or sometimes Gouda, some melted cheese, usually Velveeta. I mean, what's not to like about this? Seasoned however you would like, and kind of baked in an oven and served as an appetizer. And, you know, growing up here, and I don't think my mom ever made them because, you know, he's not Greek. This is not Greek.
Oh, you make amazing things in your house.
We would have them at different people's homes. And I thought it was just a common, you know, nationwide sort of appetizer that you could find in, like, you know, Cooking with Joy or something like that. But no, it is decidedly a Cincinnati thing.
Shout out to Julie Worley, my best friend who you've met before. She'll make them and bring them over my house.
Oh, they're so good. And so the crisis is because, go figure, the Cincinnati Dayton grocery market was the only place in the country where people were still buying Pepperidge Farm cocktail ryes. They're probably like, you know, it's like a teeny loaf of rye bread pre-sliced into little squares. And so they discontinued making their version of party rye.
I mean, even know us really?
Right. Like, and so I'm sure there's like petitions happening right now for Pepperidge Farm to continue making them. And Keith gets into this in the story. He also offers alternatives. For example, you can take like a full-size Pepperidge Farm square loaf of rye bread, cut it up into four.
No, it's too thick because yeah, then you have to cut it.
Right.
I don't even know if that's possible.
And there's other brands. I don't want to prevent you from enjoying the story yourself. But what a Cincinnati moment, you know, that we are up in arms about not being able to make hanky panks.
Is it even a Bengals game party without them? I don't know.
If you don't have Skyline Chili Dip or Hanky Panks, I don't think you have a Cincinnati Bengals party. You need to have one or the other, extra points for both. And I've never understood either, you know, is it Hanky Panks? I think that's the official name of it, but lots of people just call them Hanky Pankies.
Which works.
That sounds naughty.
Well, I think that's part of its charm.
Like, can you imagine if you're not from Cincinnati and you're showing up at a party that someone's bringing you to and you hear someone say, "Oh my goodness, Hanky Panky," and you're thinking, what's going on here? So, yes, please read Keith's story if you want to have lunch with Keith and you want to make, you know, I'm going to throw this out here just to see if anyone's listening. We will have our own private That's So Cincinnati podcast auction as well. So if any listener out there wants to make a significant, and I get to decide what significant is, contribution to my Real Men Wear Pink campaign, you can Google it up and find it. I'll twist Keith's arm to do at least one other lunch. So that's out there. You have till...
That's a very auction thing to do. If you go to these charity galas, they'll auction second things off.
It's so much. You know, maybe next year we should auction off lunch with Sherry Coolidge.
Oh, I'm just there to answer questions on Twitter at all times.
Well, last year, Paul Dougherty did this for me, a woman.
Ooh, how much did he go for?
I'm not going to say.
Oh.
But, you know, it was...
Here's
it
me
was,
with the detail questions.
It was a significant contribution to Real Men Wear Pink. But this guy who was like an uber Paul Dougherty fan, his wife, bid on it and won it for her husband. And Paul was gracious, went out. I heard they had a great time. Talk sports, talk retirement, because Paul had just retired. So these are fun things to do. And yes, between that and Hanky Panks, I think we've got a podcast, Sherry.
We do. I want to say one quick thing. I did love last week's podcast while I was gone. I listened to it while I was floating around the pool in Palm Springs. We put it on. All of us, my friends listened to the podcast and they're like, just play it out loud. Don't put your headphones on. And so we enjoyed it very much with Catherine. And I do love Michelle Young. It's great work. And then, you know, the women we were with actually had a very serious conversation about breast cancer and protecting ourselves and everything. And so I love when people tell their stories, even with the donations they make to you and you talk about it.
Right. It's about awareness and education and really getting into the whole issue of, you know, being aware if you have dense breast tissue. I had people reach out after the podcast that I haven't heard from a while, saying that they had conversations with family members like, you know, are you, you know, do you know if you have dense breast? Did you get the letter? Because a simple mammogram is not enough for about 40% of the women who have dense breast tissue. And that's not like a condition. Like that's not, you know, that's just a normal situation. But it does require a little more screening than a typical mammogram. So hats
off
to Michelle.
I missed you and loved my vacation, but I liked
the
podcast.
We missed you, Sherry. It was fun having Catherine in here as always.
All right, you guys, thank you so much. Tune in next week.